From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. What we've learned being in Moab this week is the rural American West is in transition. It's not a new revelation. This change has been coming for years now. Think about the life of the Western rancher. A recent survey found that in the last 10 years, barely a quarter of the ranches now on the market were being purchased by traditional ranchers. Developers are getting a hold of some, but most are being bought by wealthy people who keep hold of the land, but they don't work it. Heidi Red's ranch, Dugout, a 5,000-acre spread on the border of Canyonlands National Park, is a working ranch, and that's exactly how she wants it. Today in the program, Heidi Red will join us to talk about her life on the range of southern Utah and how she was able to stay on her land while ranchers all over the West are packing it in and selling it off. It's a unique arrangement and a good story, how she managed to preserve her way of life and her beloved Dugout Ranch. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Now that they've paved the road, it'll take you about an hour's drive south from Moab to get to Dugout Ranch. The spread itself takes in more than 5,000 acres, but the ranch house is nestled in a stand of cottonwoods by the side of Indian Creek. Above it is a magnificent red rock formation called the Sundial. This is Heidi Red's place. If you look west from her front yard, down country, as she puts it, you can see another formation, a grouping of ragged red pillars known as the Moki family. It's here where Heidi says she wants her ashes spread. How many of us can say we know we've found our place? For Heidi, there's no doubt. Hasn't really been one since she first arrived here some 40 years ago. She came with her husband, Robert, and at the time, she didn't know much about the life of a rancher. Today, she can't imagine anything else. It's the certainty that has guided her through an era of change for the rural American West. Even after a difficult divorce, she was able to resist the temptation to sell off the place to developers. The arrangement she made was to, with the environmental group, the Nature Conservancy, to preserve the place by selling it to them has made Heidi Red a high-profile figure, but that's only part of her story. Today on the program, we're wrapping up our series of programs here in Moab with Heidi Red. It's believed that in the next 20 years, more than 70% of the ranches now in production in the American West will change hands. Many of them will be broken up and subdivided. Some will stay intact. But a fraction will remain as working enterprises. Dugout Ranch is a working ranch. In fact, on Tuesday, Heidi, her son, and ranch hand were castrating and branding the last of the calves. There's always a lot of work to be done on a ranch, so we're grateful Heidi could make the drive into town to talk to us today. We invite you to join us as well. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Heidi moved to the Dugout Ranch in 1967 and in 1989 took over as sole operator. She lives there with her son Adam and her two grandkids and a number of ranch hands. Another son, Matt, now lives in Colorado. And Heidi Red, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I want to begin by, you were born in Ogden, Utah, grew up in Idaho, in a rural community. Did you think that then, did you imagine you wanted the life? Did you think that you would have the life of a rancher?
Of a cowgirl?
Of a cowgirl?
No, although I've always had a romance with horses and a love of the outdoors. I always knew that in some respect I would have an occupation in the outdoors and with a horse.
With a horse?
Hopefully.
Hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if when you were young and you were thinking about all of this, did you, because you've done a lot of things and we're going to talk about them, some of them, did you have a plan for what you wanted for your life? Did you map out what you... I mean, beyond, I want to end up outdoors. Did you have much of a plan besides that?
No. I think of any of us experiences in life, we never know which road we're going to end up going down. We can start off on a freeway thinking this is it, and the next thing we know, we're on a bumpy dirt road going the other direction. So it's just hard to tell where you'll end up.
When you were a fairly young girl, you asked for an aqualung, the gear for scuba diving. For Christmas or for your birthday?
For Christmas.
For Christmas. Where did that come from?
Well, at that time, this was in the 50s, there was a television show with Lloyd Bridges called Something Under the Sea. I can't remember, but...
Xenophore.
Sea Hunt, that's right.
Sea Hunt, okay.
Help from the audience, yes.
And that just intrigued me to no end. I just had to have one. I believe I was 12. And so that was my Christmas gift that year.
How much scuba diving can you do at Christmas in Idaho?
Well, that was the problem. And so I packed the gear upstairs to the bathroom and tried it in the bathtub, which was very unsatisfying. And so my dad said, well, let's put it in the car. We'll go down to Pocatello and see if we can't find a motel with a swimming pool, and you can try it out. So off we went to Pocatello. Certainly found a motel that would allow me. They were so thrilled and intrigued with this Aqualung because it was, you know, big time new thing. And I had a great time in that swimming pool.
At what point did you start jumping out of planes?
Well, I started skydiving in college. I was probably a sophomore in college. And the fellows that I was scuba diving with in Bear Lake were also skydivers. And so they invited me to try out that sport, which I dearly loved. All of us have looked at the sky of the birds flying and the hawks and just dreamed that we could do the same thing. Well, that was my vision of skydiving.
I wonder, is there any connection between skydiving, scuba diving, and the work you do now? Is there any relationship at all between those?
Well, in the fact that they're all living on the edge.
Huh.
And in ranching, of course, you have the weather to contend with, the market, disease. I mean, it is very much on the edge. In fact, I think skydiving and scuba diving are a much surer bet than ranching.
Was it the adrenaline rush part of that for you? Has that always been the case for you?
Oh, yes, and that's one thing about when you're cowboying and you're chasing a wild cow through the brush and the trees and the rocks and holes, and you're going full bore. It isn't like a rodeo where you're in an arena and you know exactly the boundaries of that arena. You're jumping sagebrush, ducking tree limbs, and going full bore after an animal, and that is definitely a rush. And when you get to be 66, and you realize more and more how long that injury is going to take to heal, you kind of wonder at times, but then the thrill of it all always takes over, and there you are again.
Do you almost stop consciously thinking about it when you're on the gallop like that? Is it almost second nature at this point?
It's second nature, and it is wonderful. Just to be out and on a horse. And, you know, in the mornings in the desert, there's just that certain smell of wet willows or wet soil, and the horse is just warming up and getting his feel for the day. Ah, you can't beat it.
I wanted to, someone who's never seen the place, I wanted you to give them a description of Dugout. Someone who's never seen Dugout, someone who really may not be that familiar, really, with the desert that surrounds it, how do you describe that place? How do you describe home?
Well, I think the first thing that I felt when I first arrived at the Dugout was you drop down into Indian Creek, and there's the Red Buttes. And it's as though those Red Buttes are welcoming arms, a serenity, a feeling of protection. And the soils are red. The sky is the most crackling blue you can ever imagine. Sagebrush, pinyon trees, Indian rice grass, which has to be the most gorgeous grass around. And at times, midday, harsh. Hmm. Evenings and mornings, loving.
Loving?
Loving. Just this nice, warm feeling. Because the light is low. It hasn't gotten up where it's the shadow, you have nice shadows. You have that sun coming down the red rock like a, just like a veil dropping down and warming up the earth.
How do you describe the heat midday? Three o'clock.
Well, the 3 o'clock heat, when you've been in the saddle since five, is pretty intense. But that's the one thing about being in the out of doors from morning till evening on a horse. You go through all those stages of the desert, from the cool morning smell and feel to that intense heat of the afternoon where everything almost goes white. And it's kind of showing you you're not the boss. It can grub you down to a little grease daub in no time. And then by evening, when it's starting to cool off again, it's giving you a little relief.
Hmm. You remember when you first came upon the Indian Creek setting where you made your home. Do you remember when you first arrived there and when you first figured, of all the acreage we have access to, this, I think this is the place, this is it?
Well, I remember the first time Robert took me down to Indian Creek. It was a dirt road when you turn off from 211 clear down. Dusty, bumpy. Then we dropped down into Indian Creek, and even that first time, the very first time on Indian Creek, it felt like home. Robert hadn't asked me to marry him at that point. It was in January on a cold, snowy, blue sky day just above the ranch headquarters looking down at the Six Shooter Peaks and the Moki family that he asked me to marry him. Great. Robert and I had shared a great life together for the times that we were together before the divorce.
Did you, so at what point did you figure you wanted to build a house here?
Well, we lived in the old cook shack, the back of the old cook shack. It was a one room. And the cowboys would come in at 4 in the morning, clump, 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 and the cook would start cooking, and we'd be getting up. And so we started planning, having our house designed about the first year we were married. And to decide where we wanted to put the house, we would take our sleeping bags and camp at various sites. But we had to stay within range of the light plant. And so that was a limiting factor to some degree. And then we found our particular spot. It was shady, had some green. And when you're out riding in the desert all day, it is very nice when you can come home to some shade and some green. I'm not often, most times of the year, like through the summer and the fall, I'm living on the mountain in a line shack. And I come home once a week for bathing and relaxing a little bit.
Heidi Redd is with us. She operates the Dugout Ranch in Utah, San Juan County. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are wrapping up our series of programs from Moab with a conversation with Heidi Redd. About an hour south of Moab on the border of Canyonlands National Park, you'll find Heidi's home for the last 40 years or so, Dugout Ranch. It's very much a working ranch, and Heidi is very much a cowgirl. It's a term she embraces, by the way. About 10 years ago, worried about the prospect of development, she sold her ranch to the Nature Conservancy to preserve it. Of course, that's only one part of a remarkable life, one story of that, and we're trying to get to as much as we can today. We invite you to join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. 801-585-9378, our email address, radiowest@keer.org. And we invite those of you with us here in the Grand County Library to join us as well. Raise your hand at some point, and we'll call on you. Tell me about your first horse. You bought him for, was it $5?
$5. I was raised in Blackfoot, Idaho, and Blackfoot had an auction, a cattle and horse auction, and I went down to the auction barn, and they used to keep the horses in a corral out back before they would bring them in to sell them. And as they were running around, we would sit on the fence and jump onto their backs and hold on to the mane and ride around and around and around until, of course, the auctioneers caught us and kicked us out. But they were auctioning off a young colt. And I worked as a lifeguard, believe it or not, at 12 years old, and had enough money to buy the colt. My parents didn't know anything about it. I just put a piece of twine around its neck and marched it home. And
they had no idea?
No. So it lived in the backyard. And that was my first horse, and very dear to my heart.
Have you ever been able, over the years, to explain in a clear way why it is that people choose this life, choose to ranch? I mean, it's more than, I mean, it's making money. That's the idea, or supposed to be, right? But there's something else, of course, right?
Well, definitely it's the lifestyle.
Yeah.
It's the love of place. It's the love of animals. And to be a cowboy or a rancher, you encompass a lot of skills. You have to know veterinary work. You have to know grasses, water. There's just a lot of business. But, you know, the business end and all the peripheral things are items that you have to do. Mm. I think the true love and the true reason why we all stay and work the land is because we love animals, being out, and nature.
I want to ask you about this trend that I've been reading about. There was this study, I think it was done recently by New Mexico State University, that found that only a quarter, about 25% of a ranch's value relates to its income earning potential. But it was another survey that I found really striking that said in the last 10 years, people who are wealthy purchased 40% of the ranches on the market compared to 26%, just barely more than a quarter, that were bought by traditional farmers, traditional ranchers. So I wanted to know what you made of that, seeing a ranch as something that's not earning its keep, not a working ranch, but it's kind of a recreational property. It's a weekend getaway. How are you reacting to that trend?
Well, I think it's an alarming trend and a very sad trend because as our world population grows, the need for food and fiber will become more and more necessary. And as these places, ranches or farms are bought and put to recreational use, we are losing more and more production for food. And I find it it's sad that the markets are such, the economic pressures are such where fuel is so high. Mm. And the it's amazing to me how we have gotten by so cheaply in the United States with food. I know this past year it has really escalated. But from what I sell my cattle for and what you purchase them at the grocery store, there is just a world of difference. And so I do know that for young people to try to get into this business, if they do not inherit it, they cannot get into it. It's either inherit this a ranch or a farm, or you cannot do it. And the average age of a rancher or farmer has to be 65.
Wow.
And unless their children are going to be inheriting it, then it will be sold for development. And how many children want to take this burden on? This financial burden.
When you talk to Adam, your son who lives with you there out at Dugout, what does he say? Is he sure? Does he wonder at times?
I don't think so. I think Adam has a true love for the work and the lifestyle. But both my boys have a true love, but the ranch can't support two more families. And so my oldest son chose to take another area of work. But he would love to be on the ranch also. But, you know, it's a true love. It's a true love of labor. And to spend 7 days a week and always be, never feel like you can truly relax because there's all the work never ends.
Yeah. Was it at all, it's been almost 20 years ago now that you and Robert were divorced, and you had a decision to make. What happens now to the ranch? And there were a number of different options. You had a number of different offers. Was it ever tempting to take one?
Well, 20 years ago, no, there was not offers to buy. Robert and I never entered that arena. When we divorced, he wanted to, he sold his end of the cattle to me and moved to Virginia. And we never entertained selling the place at that point. And then I took over management.
That came later, right?
Right. The actual worry about selling the ranch didn't come till 10 years later when it was either divide the ranch, which would then make it absolutely non-profitable for anyone, which would have meant probably subdivision or selling to someone. And that's when the high-powered buyers were coming in to look at the place.
So did you ever feel tempted?
No.
Why?
What do you do with money if you aren't where you were meant to be and doing what you were meant to be doing? I mean, what would I have done? Gone on cruises? I don't think so.
So when did the idea of approaching the Nature Conservancy, when did that come to you?
Well, when the real estate people started coming, and I knew that Robert's interest, and he certainly had every right to do with his interests as he chose, but I couldn't go to the bank and borrow that much money. And I had met Chris Monahue years before and knew of the Conservancy and what they were doing. And so I thought, well, maybe this is a way that we can get enough money to satisfy the economic pressures, and I can make a deal to stay. And after 4 years of negotiations, that's exactly what happened. And I just feel so... like Chris Monahue and Dave Livermore are my heroes, because without them and their help, I'm afraid the Dugout eventually would have been subdivided. It would probably be a little bit like Moab or Castle Valley.
Well, good transition to Chris Monahue, who's joining us now, Director of Conservation Programs for the Nature Conservancy in Utah. He's been with the organization for some 20 years. He worked with Heidi, as she mentioned, when they purchased the Dugout Ranch, and he's joining us today by phone from his office in Salt Lake. Chris Monahue, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Doug. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, Chris.
Oh, Chris, I want to ask you, give me your reaction when Heidi first, I guess, made the call or first approached you with the idea.
Well, as Heidi said, we'd met earlier, a couple of years earlier, and when I first got the call and Heidi came in to talk, that's kind of an unusual thing in itself, is you know, ranchers and conservationists reaching out to each other, but it was obvious that we had a lot in common as far as the landscape and the ranch and the kinds of values that the Nature Conservancy is working to protect or very similar to the kinds of values that Heidi was used to working to protect and preserve. So it was unusual, but it didn't really take long, I don't think, for us to get comfortable with each other and start trying to figure out this very complicated challenge that was going to face everybody.
There were questions about whether, you know, ranching, whether running cattle in the West is really good for the health of certain parts of the environment. Why is it you agreed to keep it as a working ranch? That's important to Heidi. Why did you figure that you could make that work when there were a lot of environmental concerns about all of that?
Well, we knew enough to know that Heidi was on the upper end of the scale as far as her stewardship and her commitment to the property, and really it was a key feature of what Heidi wanted to see happen. I'm not so sure if we hadn't all committed to keeping the property a working ranch in some fashion that it really would have gone forward. But, you know, I think there's always, and on a ranch that encompasses about 300,000 acres, you know, there are going to be issues with maybe not every acre is in perfect condition, but basically overall, you know, Heidi's been a great steward, and we just felt like, yeah, we can figure this out. We can figure out how to keep this ranch operating as a ranch and do really good conservation work at the same time. So we had, you know, we just had an optimistic attitude about being able to work it out.
What do you think, Chris, you've learned from the dugout ranch relationship? What does the Nature Conservancy learn from that you apply, I guess, for the way, you know, the conservation movement in general, you know, relates to ranchers and others?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've learned personally an awful lot from working with Heidi and her family and the ranch project. You know, I think primarily you have to have some sort of common vision to kind of pull off something at this scale. And the landscape is such a powerful and inspirational place. You see that kind of mirrored in Heidi. She's you know, it's very clear that she's a strong individual and unique and loves the place, and that is another, her commitment to the place is another key factor that has to be in place. As far as the conservancy and the ranch, I think it just shows that there can be a lot of power and energy and action generated between what you would consider maybe not to be the most compatible of partners, as long as you have a common vision. And you know, I just think that's been, you know, that attitude has been borne out, is that, you know, non-traditional partnerships can work, and they can produce great conservation at a very big scale.
Is this relationship with Heidi, is it unique in the scheme of things, or does it represent a trend, or, you know, are there other possibilities for things like this, do you think, in the West?
Well, I'd have to agree with Heidi and her kind of assessment of the trend of the way the ranches and ranching is going in agriculture, that it's getting to be a tougher and tougher world economically and otherwise to survive as a rancher, but I think you know, there's more and more recognition, I think, on the conservation community side that these ranches are large, intact pieces of the landscape that we all care about and care about conserving, and that you've just, you know, they're very important players in conservation in the West. And no matter what philosophy you bring to that interaction, you need to figure out how to work together to achieve both ends. And so I think that's a trend, actually, that's growing, is that, you know, ranchers are important to conservation, and the conservation community needs to figure out how to work productively with ranchers at a big scale west-wide.
Heidi Redd, how did other ranchers react to this relationship, to this decision? I mean, there's in the past, certainly there's been some suspicion by ranchers of conservation groups. What did they make of your decision to do this?
Well, I don't know if I'd say some suspicion, but definitely suspicion. I've been vice president of the Utah Cattlemen's Association and president of the San Juan Cattlemen's Association in the past, and on the Public Lands Council for cattlemen. And they all were very suspicious that the Conservancy within a few years would have all the cattle gone. And I think we, after 10 years, they are slowly beginning to trust and see that my relationship with the Conservancy has been beneficial, and that there are still cattle on the range. And, of course, that was their prediction. Oh, within 5 years, 10 years, they'll have you off of there. And so I think they're coming around that this has been a good partnership.
Well, I asked Chris what the Nature Conservancy learned from the relationship. What do you figure you learned doing all of this?
With the having a partner?
Yeah.
Well, being somewhat of a loner, having a partner has been interesting, but the Conservancy is a very easy marriage in that they are willing to listen to my side and the direction I feel we should be going or I should be going, and we work it out, so it'll work. And the new phase that we'll be starting within 4 or 5 years will be an exciting experiment for the Dugout Ranch in the science arena. And I see science and the cattle industry and what we can gain from this partnership is going to be very valuable for the future. And Chris can probably elaborate a lot more on the Science Center.
Head into a break in a minute. Chris, say something finally, this idea of science, applying it to the questions of the West.
Well, the Dugout Ranch is such a unique place, and it has so much representativeness of the whole Colorado Plateau just captured within its boundaries that we felt for some time that in the face of climate change and just differing land use that the ranch could be a place where we could actually do research both on climate change and land use and those interactions, and we might learn some things that would be applicable elsewhere on the Colorado Plateau, so that besides being a spectacular and powerful landscape and working ranch, it could make this other contribution. So we're kind of moving in that direction with Heidi and with other partners to see if we can really use the ranch in that way and make a greater conservation contribution to an even bigger scale.
Chris Montague, he's Director of Conservation Programs for the Nature Conservancy in Utah, joined us from his office in Salt Lake. Chris, thanks.
You bet. Thank you.
801-585-WEST is the number, by the way, to join the conversation. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're live in the Grand County Library on Center Street in Moab, Utah, wrapping up our series of programs broadcasting live from this city. We're with Heidi Redd, and we invite you to join us. But we're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking to Heidi Redd. It's the last in a series of programs broadcast live from Moab. We're in the Grand County Library here in Moab talking to Heidi. Heidi's ranch, Dugout, a 5,000-acre spread on the border of Canyonlands National Park, is a working ranch, and it's exactly how she wants it. You can join us at 801-585-WEST or send us an email, radiowest@kuer.org. I want to read a quote I found you said this about a couple years ago. You were talking about the people who come to national parks, some of them anyway, recreationists. You said this. You said they don't come for solace anymore. They're as frantic in the recreation as they are in their jobs. What did you mean? Do you still mean it?
Yes. It's very interesting to see recreation going as at fast a pace as city life. Hmm. I can be taking a herd of cattle down country, and cars will be passing, and they hardly want to slow down. They're going down to the park. They will pass us, and with 1/2 hour from the time they've passed us, they've gone down to the park,
and they're back.
Gone into that museum, and turned around, and they're heading out. Maybe they have their sticker on their window that said, "I have visited this national park," and that's it. And then we have ATV people. Now, there's two types of ATV people. There's the older set that loves being out. They can't hike or carry their backpack anymore, and they're out seeing the country. Then you have the type that there isn't a sand dune or a hill that they cannot conquer and rip the soil to pieces doing it. Then you have, in my area lately, are the slick rock climbers that
you have problems with.
I have problems with, because they pound pitons into my red rocks, and they are dominating. They are trying to dominate the Wingate and show that it's possible. I can tell you, from 40 years at the dugout, you're never going to be the boss of the desert. The desert calls the tune constantly, as it should. And so I get hurt when I see the number of people not only trying to dominate the Wingate, but trying to make every spot a new campsite.
So you see a kind of change going on. What is it? Is it that there's not a... they've lost that connection with the land?
That's the way I feel, is that feeling of wanting to commune with nature and be a part of it. No blending in with the landscape. It's being definitely trying to be in control of it.
You know, it's interesting. I've heard you talk about cows with this sheer affection. Like, you know, I think a lot of people sort of see cows as they're not supposed to be there, that's not their place, but you see them differently. You think they're smart. You really like them.
I do love cows, and they are smart, and they do have social groupings, and they're able to survive in the desert, along with even though they're domestic animals. Sometimes I wonder about that, and there are times when I call them, probably can't say it on the radio, what I call them, and, you know, I'm cracking my whip above them and, you know, trying to get them to go. But my affection for my cattle is the same as my affection for my horse. To find them clean water, good grass, and a peaceful life.
I want to ask you about your relationship to the native peoples who lived in this country, you know, hundreds, some thousands of years ago. But before that, I want to have you listen to this audio essay. During our stay here, we've been airing radio essays from a series called Voices of Youth Moab. Since 1999, producer Bruce Hucko has worked with the Grand County School District and the local community radio station, KZMU. They help students create audio essays. Athena Hawks just finished her junior year at Grand County High School. She's here in the crowd, by the way. Her grandfather, Ralph Hawks, is an old Moab cowboy. And this past winter, she sat down with him to talk about the stories that he'd heard from friends and family members who had taken part in wild horse roundups in the backcountry. He and others told her the legend of Dead Horse Point, a promontory in the steep cliffs of the canyon country. Athena shares the story and imagines what it must have been like from the horse's perspective.
Back in the early days of Moab, they had quite a few wild horses out on the desert, out in the canyonlands in the San Rafael. And the cowboys around Moab used to go out there and chase horses every once in a while.
It is no uncommon myth, the legend of Dead Horse Point. It is a story passed down from generation to generation, one told as a piece of our history, remembering those old cowboys who are our childhood heroes. But what we have forgotten to see is that it was not the cowboys who made the myth what it was.
One day there was a few cowboys went out there and rounded up probably 20 wild horses and drove them out onto Dead Horse Point.
And that kept the horses there, so all they had to do was put one fence up, and that made a natural corral for all of them. And then the cowboys can go in and pick the nice ones. The rest of them were called broomtails. And they were just wild, ugly horses.
We represented the Western frontier.
But we had been left for dead.
The water that our mouths so desperately sought after, just a deadly drop below.
They left them out there for 8, 10, 15 days, I don't remember, but quite a while until the horses got so thirsty, they literally jumped off at Dead Horse Point, tried to get to the river.
I think the story of Dead Horse Point was sad in the sense that many horses were killed, lost their lives because they weren't taken care of. And I think we can relate that to life, that we need to take care of each other, take care of those for whom we have responsibilities.
Dead Horse Point isn't just a mesa that stands 2,000 feet above the river. It is a reminder that a voice can stand out throughout the ages. We can't change the past, but we can change whose voice it is that tells the story.
That's what got the name of Dead Horse Point.
That story was produced by Athena Hawks. She's a high school student here in Moab. She's going to be a senior next year. Her grandfather, you heard there, Ralph, and also her father, Jimmy Hawks. She created the piece for Voices of Youth Moab. You can hear more from the series by following the link on our website at KUER.org. Heidi Redd, respond to that, if you would. You've talked about this before, feeling a sense of the people who... The stories, the traditions, the myths, the sort of sense of the people themselves when you're out in the country.
And it's a very sad story. But that's right. When I've often said that my 40 years at the dugout and being able to meet the payroll and pay the bills isn't because I have any special way or that I'm a guru on the market. I think it's because the spirits of the old ancient Anasazis and the cowboys are for some reason with me and ride with me, and that I pay them homage and feel a relationship with them. The Anasazi built such beautiful homes that you just can't help but know how much they loved the country. And there's always a danger when a person is engaged in a livelihood on the land that they will lose touch with the beauty around them just by trying to scratch out a living. And I've always felt that if I ever came to that point where I couldn't look up and see the beauty and feel the beauty and the people that came before me, that's when I need to quit. And so I have a great love and respect for the people that worked the land before I did. And, you know, the dugout encompasses 300,000 acres. 5,000 of it is private. And the only way I manage the cattle and work the cattle with a horse. So I depend wholly on my horses to get me around and do the work. And it's interesting, my favorite horse, Waddy, who is a quarter horse thoroughbred cross, if I ever touch him with the spurs, he turns around and looks at me like, "What are you thinking? We will get there." And hey, have some respect here. And it's really true, because without the horses and taking good care of the horses, we would have hell to pay to get the cows where they should be.
Would you say something about your cowboy hat? You have an affection for a good hat.
I do. And this is my town hat. I have working hats and town hats. And
I'm not going to ask you to take it off, by the way, Heidi.
Oh, no.
I know what the answer would be.
My town hats are custom made in Durango, Colorado. And a town hat, my town hats are 100X. That means they're 100% beaver. And my working hat is only a 10X. So it isn't nearly as costly or as precious to me. If it falls in the water trough, I don't care much. But this town hat, I take care of it.
I think we have time for a call from Dale, who is joining us in Provo. Dale, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Yes. I'm not sure I understand this right, but before the Reds took over the ranch, I thought it was, is it right that that was established by the Scorup brothers, Albert and Jim Scorup? Weren't they the first and original owners of that ranch?
Well, they were not the original owners. Of course, the Anasazi were the original owners, and then after the Anasazi, a fellow by the name of Jim Trout had the original Indian Creek Cattle Company with the V-Bar brand. In 1918, Jim Scorup and Al Scorup purchased Indian Creek from Jim Trout. I now own Indian Creek Cattle Company. So it has been established since the mid-1800s and is still going.
Well, the other question I have is, as I recall, in reading the Scorup brothers' kind of history, that they had an awful lot of trouble with a lot of horses on the ranch, and that one of the main problems they had was removing the horses so that there would be enough grass for their cattle. And I was wondering if horses have come back into that area, and you have trouble with them on your range now.
Wild horses?
No, we have no wild horses. And actually, Jim and Al really didn't have trouble with wild horses. What they had trouble with was Texas cattlemen. This was before the Taylor Grazing Act. And so it was a free-for-all for range. And so it didn't matter if you had 10,000 or 5,000, whoever was there first with their cattle. I mean, there were gunfights and there was all kinds of problems.
Dale, thanks
very
much.
I appreciate your efforts. Being in the cattle business myself, I know it's a big job, and I think you do a great job down there. Thank you very much for your comments.
Let me ask you, Heidi Redd, what are you thinking about now? What's the work that needs to be done on the ranch? You probably have something on your mind, right?
Oh, yeah. Every night, all night. Right now we are finishing up the spring branding, getting ready to move. I have three herds on these 300,000 acres, and as soon as we're branded, I start on the forest on June 16th, and each of these herds will take me between a week and maybe 2 weeks to get onto the forest and located. So I have a good month of just gathering herds, and each of these pastures I gather with these herds is, you know, close to 50 to 60,000 acres, and so there's a lot of gathering and moving of small calves to do.
You know, there's a lot of work to be done. Let me ask you this finally. You're alone out there. I mean, you have your family, but this question comes up from time to time. You ever get lonely?
Well, I think loneliness is inherited. It's loneliness is something we all have at times, and I really can't say that I get lonely, and I've often said that the loneliest people I know sometimes are married people, and the dugout never sasses me, never gives me any reason to be lonely. It's always there, open arms.
Heidi Redd. Heidi, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, we have a lot of people to thank for making our Moab shows possible. We thank Bruce Hucko, KZMU, and the Grand County School District, all part of the Voices of Youth Moab Project. Our thanks to Tunnel Vision Music here in Moab. We were hosted by the Grand County Library. Our thanks to the director, Carrie Valdez, and to Andrea Lund and Mike Baird. The broadcast was made possible through the Utah Education Network by Jeff Egli, Steve Chipman, Galen Williams. Our thanks to KUER's field engineer, Dennis Johnson. The show was directed today by our chief engineer, Lewis Downey, with support from Mike Anderson, Dan Bomas, Michael Havey, Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and Jenny Brundine back in the studio. The program is produced by Elaine Clark, and I'm Doug Fabrizio.